From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Thursday is the Jewish observance of Yom HaAtzmaut. And at the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, the last two men standing between Donald Trump and the Republican presidential nomination dropped out. With Cruz and Kasich out of the running, we'll see now just how close to the White House the divisive rhetoric so many of us have found so disturbing will take the Donald. Things are harder to parse on the Democratic side of the race right now. Despite his victory in Indiana, many are saying it's time for Bernie Sanders to drop out of the race in the name of party unity. But even Hillary Clinton didn't take that step in 2008 until June. The U.S. Justice Department warned North Carolina that the state's notorious bathroom bill may violate federal civil rights laws. Meanwhile, a group in Illinois is suing the federal government in the opposite direction, claiming that the education department's violating the rights of non-transgender students to pretend there are no transgender people in Illinois, I suppose. Let me just U.S. District Court backlash show. The suit was brought with the support of, say it with me, the nonprofit legal group Alliance Defending Freedom. Oh, yes, without these fine folks always available to help, our freedom would have been left defenseless long ago. And now that the hit Fox TV series American Idol has ended after 15 seasons, the network is trying something new, a talk show starring four megachurch pastors. I think it would probably be more compelling if they brought back Simon Cowell to judge their performance. And now, here's what's coming up on State of Belief Radio this week.
Well, say your sorry mind.
You can't disagree with voters when they vote.
No,
say your sorry mind.
What if we finally reach the limits of how loudly we can shout at each other about politics, candidates, and campaigns? What if the next step isn't to find some way to turn up the volume even higher, but instead to shut up, to think, and to listen? May is National Meditation Month. And as opposed to thoughtful passivity, as too many people understand meditation, leading practitioners are calling on Americans to meditate the vote. And yes, there's a hashtag for that. On this week's show, I'll talk with Sister Jenna, founder of the Meditation Museum near Washington, D.C., and one of the initiators of Meditate the Vote.
Do you stand, for example, by the idea of a ban against foreign Muslims coming here?
I do. We have to be vigilant. We have to be strong.
A position Donald Trump shamelessly reiterated just this week. The poisoning of the political discourse would be bad enough, but a new report seems to confirm that it also has a very real impact on individual human lives, as acceptability of hateful rhetoric provides cover for acts of violence. The Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University has just released that report. It's called When Islamophobia Turns Violent, the 2016 presidential elections, and we'll hear from Inge Abdelkader, assistant director of the initiative. But first,
the way this is written, this would basically give a blanket right to discriminate to any subcontractor within the Department of Defense and would prohibit us and the federal government from saying, look, if you're going to do that, we don't want to do business with you.
The conventional wisdom of recent months, at least on the progressive side of what we used to call the culture wars, has been that the proliferation of state-level legislation clearly targeting LGBT taxpayers for discrimination was a last gasp of a dying and outdated conservative agenda. There may yet be some short-term harms, the thinking goes, but it's just a matter of time before the whole thing sorts itself out. Now, however, there is a new threat poised to roll back some of the progress made in recent years in the form of language embedded in a must-pass military funding bill. Among the voices raising the alarm over this shameless manipulation of the National Defense Authorization Act has been the Center for American Progress, and I am happy to be joined now by Sarah McBride, Campaigns and Communications Manager for the LGBT Research and Communications Project at CAP. Sarah, welcome to State of Believe Radio.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be on.
Tell our listeners, what exactly is the problem with what's happening to the NDAA?
What has happened over the last several days, and it was actually added as an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act in the wee hours of the morning a week ago last Thursday, was an amendment that attempted to exempt several federal contractors from the president's recent executive order banning discrimination against LGBT employees of federal contractors, which expanded protections, enhanced protections for 28 million workers nationwide. And NDAA is a must-pass bill, and the fact that an extreme element of the House of Representatives has successfully added this in is, I think, a reflection of two things. One, it's a reflection of the fact that this Congress doesn't do much, and this do-nothing Congress, extreme elements in this do-nothing Congress, know that the only way to advance their extreme agenda is to attach this measure mm-hmm. onto a bill that is a must-pass bill. Mm-hmm. And the second is, in all of the ways that they've done this, it reinforces the fact that this is an unpopular action. This is an action that was added under the cloak of darkness, and it's an amendment to a massive bill that they're hoping will distract from the harm they're trying to do with this amendment. And I think so long as members of Congress on both sides of the aisle and both chambers stand up and say, we will not be importing the hate we saw in North Carolina or Mississippi into the halls of Congress, we're not going to let the National Defense Authorization Act be utilized to advance an extreme discriminatory agenda. So long as enough members stand up and get this out of the bill, I think we'll be good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a sad state to see a couple members of the House of Representatives not learn the clear lessons from North Carolina.
Sir, give us an idea of how widespread the impact of passing that bill would be.
The amendment is sort of sneakily worded, and it's very vague. And at first glance, to your average layperson, I'm not an attorney, but to first glance, the amendment seems somewhat benign. But in reality, through some really clever legal maneuvering and legislative maneuvering, the legislation would grant religiously affiliated institutions that receive federal funds that are held to a standard in all other non-discrimination protections, it would grant them effectively a license to discriminate against LGBT employees. So that might be a transgender custodian at a major hospital. Mm-hmm. It could be a gay worker who's working for a federal contractor that is seeking to get their legally married spouse onto their health insurance. It would mm-hmm. allow for that type of discrimination. And because it's so vaguely worded, the impact could extend beyond the LGBT community. It could allow for discrimination against divorce workers or even pregnant unmarried workers.
Could there be repercussions even beyond the federal contractors?
Well, this amendment itself is limited to federal contractors, mm-hmm. but I think it is part of a larger strategy by some in the House of Representatives to undermine all of the progress that we've seen. That could look like trying to ensure that the Supreme Court moves in a direction that would no longer be friendly to LGBT Americans. That includes the new hearing that's scheduled for what's called the First Amendment Defense Act, which would severely limit the ability of the federal government to enforce non-discrimination protections.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously this amendment. So while this one's limited to federal contractors, part of an overall strategy, and encroachments on equality happen incrementally. Mm-hmm. It's bit by bit. And any step that we allow them to take to remove and rescind protections that LGBT people have creates a very dangerous precedent mm-hmm. for LGBT people and non-LGBT people across the country.
Sarah, not even the members of Congress, or especially not even the members of Congress, dealing with a bill that is as massive as this one, are likely to be reading all of that proposed legislation. So that means someone has to find this. Someone has to identify the danger of this addition to it that we all are now talking about. Who finds that kind of attachment? And then am I correct that you go first probably to staff members of the members of Congress who are going to be the ones that have to get the message to the members of Congress themselves?
Fortunately, we have some incredible advocates for LGBT equality in Congress, mm-hmm. both out members of Congress and allied members of Congress, as well as some amazing staff that really have the LGBT community's back and are keeping an eye out for us. The Armed Services Committee voted in favor of this amendment. So there was a period of time around 2 a.m. where the Armed Services Committee did discuss and debate this. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in discussing and debating it, those who are on the Armed Services Committee who do have the back of LGBT Americans, they did realize what was happening. And actually, all of the Democrats, as well as two Republicans on the committee, voted against this amendment when it was introduced because they could see pretty clearly that this was a thinly veiled attempt to use the important American principle of religious freedom and religious liberty to disingenuously push an anti-LGBT agenda, which is something that we're seeing far too often.
Mm-hmm. Is there some implication of hope that this can be removed from the legislation?
I think we are cautiously optimistic that at the end of the day, the final National Defense Authorization Act that is passed and signed into law will not include this language. But of course, as with everything in Washington, as with everything in life, that takes action and that takes individuals engaging on this issue, that takes voters contacting their members of Congress saying, I heard about this amendment and this won't stand. So we need to make sure that we hold their feet to the fire. But I'm confident that if we continue to do so, the amendment will not be included in the final version that reaches the president's desk.
Sarah, I want to go all the way back to the way I began to introduce this segment. I started out by saying that conventional wisdom suggests the culture wars are pretty much over. Do you think that's a premature attitude to have? How entrenched are the forces of discrimination, and where are they likely to pop up next?
I think what's clear is that the fundamental landscape of America's culture wars, as we've come to know them, have changed. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, our side, the side of equality, the side of social progress, was probably on the defensive. Mm-hmm. I think we're now on the offensive. I think we are winning this effort for equality. I think we are winning hearts and minds, opening hearts and minds, and I think the American public realizes the mistakes that our country has made in the past and doesn't want to repeat them. But I do think that those who find themselves on the other side are deeply entrenched in their position. In North Carolina, we have seen the federal government threaten billions of dollars in federal funding. We've seen businesses pull back or threaten to pull back over $500 million in economic activity in the state. That's been enough to, I think, soften support for bills like HB2 in North Carolina among some folks, but there are still some who are fighting desperately to keep America from moving forward, that are fighting desperately to enshrine discrimination into our laws. And I think that'll continue. And the only way for us to continue to win this effort, for us to continue to push our country forward, is for people to not go home prematurely, to continue the fight, and to make clear that that effort is not over, that marriage equality is not the end, that LGBT people and frankly, people of all marginalized backgrounds still face both legal and non-legal discrimination throughout daily life.
Sarah McBride is the Campaigns and Communications Manager for the LGBT Research and Communications Project at the Center for American Progress. CAP is working hard to stop underhanded legislative efforts to undo anti-discrimination regulations in the guise of language embedded in the important National Defense Authorization Act. Sarah, I want to tell you how much I appreciate what CAP does and specifically what you are doing, and I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
The pleasure is all mine. Thanks for everything you're doing.
If Muslim bashing in a political campaign were just something a candidate got to engage in with impunity, it would certainly be bad enough. But what if the words of a candidate who, for far too long, was not taken very seriously had serious real-world impacts on our fellow Americans who practice or are perceived to practice the world's second-largest religion? A disturbing new report titled When Islamophobia Turns Violent, the 2016 Presidential Elections, has just been released by the Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University, and I am very grateful that it brings the initiative's assistant director, Inge Abdelkader, to State of Belief Radio. She joins me now from London.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to this conversation.
I suppose it would be naive to assume political rhetoric has no impact on real-world experiences, but the evidence laid out in this report is really shocking. So would you start with just a brief overview of the report?
Sure. So perhaps I can explain how we decided to conduct this research in the first place. Essentially, what we were seeing is a lot of Islamophobic political rhetoric since the election season began last March when Texan Senator Ted Cruz declared his candidacy for high office. And then after he did that, there were other individuals who also declared their intention to run. And we saw this onslaught of Islamophobic rhetoric. And with that, we also saw an uptick in incidents of anti-Muslim violence. And there was a strong perception among American Muslim leaders as well as activists that there was a correlative relationship, that there was a positive relationship between the rhetoric that was being spread throughout the country by these candidates and these incidents of and threats of violence targeting American Muslims and American Muslim institutions. Mm-hmm. In fact, when President Obama paid his first visit to an American mosque a couple of months ago, during the course of his speech, he actually spoke about the tone and tenor of the political rhetoric, expressing his concern, and in fact then went on to say that it is therefore no surprise that the American Muslim community is being attacked and targeted by hate crimes in the manner that they are. But what we realized at the Bridge Initiative is essentially there is no research to back up these suspicions. And so we decided to undertake that research to figure out, is this true? Is it not true? Is there a relationship between the rhetoric and the attacks? And so we examined actually two distinct periods of time. First, we looked at the course of 2015 and just coursed over surveyed media reports relating to acts and threats of violence targeting Muslims or those perceived to be Muslims, as well as their organizations, institutions, homes, businesses. And then we looked more specifically at the presidential election season commencing in March of last year when Cruz announced his candidacy for office. And what we found is that last year, the election started in an environment of already rising Islamophobia. There were at least 174 acts or threats of anti-Muslim violence. And these included a dozen murders. It included almost that many shootings and bombings, arsons, physical assaults, verbal threats, armed protests out of mosques, which were intimidating, vandalisms, so on and so forth. What we also, as I said, looked at is the presidential election cycle, and we found that there were 180 acts or threats of violence targeting Muslims. So even more acts or threats of violence, attacks targeting Muslims during the presidential election season than just the course of 2015. And we did find that there was a relationship between much of this Islamophobic political rhetoric, particularly in the months of November and December of last year.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about some of the trends that you very helpfully identified for readers of the report.
Some of these attacks included perpetrators, attackers, who were in fact children or youth themselves. Some of these examples include a 12 or 13-year-old on a bus threatening a fellow schoolmate that he's going to shoot him and characterizing him as a terrorist. Another incident involved a sixth-grade female student in New York who was physically assaulted by three schoolmates who were between the ages of 12 and 13 years old. In fact, the assault during her recess was so severe that the police were called and the youth were arrested. In another instance, there was a case of a Sikh man. So this is an individual who's not actually Muslim, but was perceived to be Muslim because of stereotyping surrounding that group, specifically the turban and the darker complexion skin that the victim had. He was mistaken for being Muslim and was actually run over by a 17-year-old. In another instance, there was a woman who was dining with her 9-year-old daughter, and she was physically attacked by a 19-year-old who yelled during that assault, "Kill all Muslims and white power." Mm-hmm. So, you know, we found it very disturbing that the perpetrators were not necessarily 30-year-olds or 40-year-olds, mm-hmm. but really young. You know, we're talking about American youth, and that was disturbing to us as well.
Do you have any knowledge or even a hunch as to whether or not any of the political candidates particularly who have engaged in this kind of vicious rhetoric, whether or not they know what some of the consequences of their words have been?
In terms of consequences, that means different things to different people, so it really depends on your perspective, right? So what our report reveals that the first surge in Islamophobic political rhetoric came in September of last year. Mm-hmm. And based on our research, that's also related to the deepening crisis surrounding the Syrian refugees and the fact that it dominated news headlines in the United States and Europe. That coverage was overwhelmingly negative. And contextualized immigrants and migrants and refugees as a threat, as a group to be feared, as a group to blame our problems on. Mm-hmm. What happened last September is that Dr. Ben Carson declared that a Muslim should not be permitted to run or to serve for high office mm-hmm. in the United States. And he was actually supported by some of the other candidates, such as Rick Santorum and Bobby Jindal, who agreed with that assessment. And that was when we first saw this onslaught of Islamophobic political rhetoric. Now, I raise it in the context of your question about consequences, because what happened after that was that Ben Carson actually saw an increase in financial contributions, mm-hmm. right? So the message that these candidates receive is that it pays to be Islamophobic. Mm-hmm. So that's one consequence, I think, of that. Also, regarding Mr. Trump's favorability ratings, last December, after he made his statement banning Muslim immigration to the United States, his approval ratings actually increased, which, again, is disturbing. Now, particularly as we head into, the general election, I do think that Americans as a whole will ultimately reject that sort of bigotry.
Angie, is there any other part of this report that we haven't talked about that we should talk about?
No, I mean, again, you know, we've focused quite a bit on Mr. Trump, but this, you know, the Islamophobic political rhetoric can be found among many of the presidential mm-hmm. candidates who've, you know, since terminated their campaigns.
Right.
Sikhs and even Christians, African Americans are sometimes targeted in anti-Muslim attacks, despite the fact that they're not Muslim, but they're perceived to be Muslim. You know, this is a problem that affects everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We also found through our research that anti-Muslim attacks are not limited to a particular
area of the United States. It's not just a problem in the South or on the West Coast. While we found that the sheer number of attacks was occurred most frequently in California and Texas, respectively, last year, the attacks were distributed throughout the country. And I think it speaks to the fact that Islamophobia is a national problem that's in need of a national solution. And, you know, despite the fact that we found that research indicates that men, Muslim men or men who are perceived to be Muslim, are more likely to be subject to physical assault and to be victims of murder, so the lethal effects of Islamophobia, Muslim women still remain very much vulnerable. You know, there are a number of cases of, you know, a Muslim woman, a 19-year-old Muslim woman, walking in New York late last year with a friend speaking Urdu, which is a language found in Pakistan, who was physically assaulted, and she had to be rushed to the hospital emergency room and undergo surgery for a broken jaw. So we're really talking about, you know, the very real brutality in these violent attacks. And similarly, we found in another incident a Muslim woman who was speaking Swahili to her family members and was also wearing Muslim religious attire, who was also targeted and viciously attacked as well. You know, the commonality there and what we find in some other cases too is this role of language. So it's not just the role of religious attire identifying an individual as being Muslim, but it's also the role of individuals speaking a language other than English, which speaks to the underlying xenophobia that informs these attacks as well.
I'd like for you just succinctly to tell our listeners about the Bridge Initiative, what you're doing, and if there's a way we can be involved, how that could be.
Of course. So we officially launched at the Center for Muslim Christian Understanding, located at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, late last year. And our mission is to raise awareness about Islamophobia. And we try and do this. Our niche is connecting the academic study of Islamophobia to the public square. So essentially, you know, we have access to so much research that we conduct ourselves, as well as research that our colleagues are conducting and other reputable and elite universities throughout the country and the world about Muslims, about anti-Muslim sentiment, and really being able to introduce that research, to introduce the empirical evidence into these discourses. So that way, when we're not just espousing our opinions, we're really putting out information that's based on objective evidence. And we would welcome the opportunity to continue this conversation.
Angie Abdulkader is the Assistant Director of the Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University. They've just published a disturbing new report titled When Islamophobia Turns Violent, the 2016 Presidential Elections, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Angie, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your travels to speak with us today. We're very grateful for the work that you're doing. We want to encourage it. We want to get the information out about it. And so you're always welcome to come back and be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to it.
Yelling, screaming, protests, counter-protests? Is that really all that the critical process of electing our nation's leaders can be anymore? My next guest has another approach. As a respected teacher, public speaker, and leader, Sister Jenna is the founder of the Meditation Museum located in Silver Spring, Maryland, and McLean, Virginia. She's also one of the initiators of Meditate the Vote, an idea too radical in today's hopelessly noisy political climate not to be taken seriously. And so, Sister Jenna, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, and I'm hoping that it's a very gentle radicalism that we're creating.
gentle radicalism. That's a good place to start. So that leads right to the first question. Meditate the Vote. Tell me how that works.
Well, if you'd like to join me, I was on the top of the mountain in India, 5,000 feet above sea level in the Aravalli Mountains. And I think, Welton, people might be thinking, of course, she was like out there. But here I was, Welton, on the mountaintop in India, and I'm amongst friends from 100 countries. 100 countries. There are about 12,000 of us. And on the first night, what was presented to me as a life question was, Sister Jenna, do you think Donald Trump is going to be the next president of the United States? Hmm. And it was just that tone, like just that question in a sense of wisdom, concern, like, do you think so? And I couldn't answer because I said, I can't go there. I'm still watching the process. And that's actually the crux, the initiation of that. And then the next day, Welton, I wrote an article for HuffPost called Far Away from American Politics. And then about a few weeks after that, I met with a few friends who were leaders as well. And we thought about how can we just sit back and not play a part in this incredible political climate that we're witnessing. And we have no idea where it's going to take us. Mm-hmm. And so Meditate the Vote came out of that, like a conversation out of silence from a mountaintop, and it all dovetailed into this campaign that we started on May 1st.
Well, tell us what really deep, profound needs does this approach help satisfy that yelling and screaming don't?
First, let me say that Meditate the Vote's not going to take sides. I don't think we want to contribute to the polarizing sort of a conversation that we're witnessing today. I think that each of these candidates, they're representing something that has been stirring up in the country for a long time. So I don't think we can point the finger on Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and we know that Ted Cruz has just recently dropped out after the Indiana primaries. But we're actually getting a chance, Welton, to look at perhaps who we are or the state that we're in presently, and this is ushering us to think from a deeper level. And this is the languaging and the focus that I would really like everyone who participates in Meditate the Vote to come from a place, because if you and I start to take sides, we're going to end up exactly in the state that we're witnessing, the yelling, the screaming, who's right, who's wrong, who belongs, who doesn't belong. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but I want you to tell me the specifics about how this gets a person to a new place in the mind and in the heart, because I am mindful that you want to be nonpartisan, but I'm also mindful that it was both inquisitiveness and some fear among colleagues around the world that even got you thinking in this direction. And I want to know how we put all that together.
Firstly, I think that we have seen for decades now, every presidential candidate has promised us better health care, higher education, more jobs, lower taxes. And thus far, I don't know what's the process completely in Washington on the Hill, but no one has really cured any of that, right? So it's been the card that everyone has used to get everybody on their side. And I'm trying to see in my alliance of friends who are ranging from educators to religious leaders to entrepreneurs to spiritual voices to the millennials, what we're trying to do is to initiate within the country more wisdom, more of an awareness that don't wait on leaders. If you need better health care, what are you doing to take care of your health? If you need job opportunity, what are you doing to check on what your gifts and your talents are within you? How much do you believe in yourself that you can push yourself a little bit against the grain of life to make things work for you? But if we are expecting ourselves to increase the over 47% of Americans who are taking a lot from the country, and if we can reduce that percentage where we become Americans who are giving more to the country, that's what Meditate the Vote is about, Welton. I mean, one of the first questions that we engage people in conversation with Meditate the Vote is, I want you to ponder on this. Are you powerful enough to affect change? And are you powerful enough to sustain the change that you have designed for mm-hmm. your life. And this will make you and I both think more rather than point the fingers. Mm-hmm. Well, Hillary, she's not doing hers, but this guy, Donald, he keeps yelling at people and mm-hmm. dividing people and building walls. I don't know how the country is going to function. Okay, we get that. But what are now you doing? We cannot be less than for ourselves despite who is in charge of this great nation. We have got to become powerful ourselves as people, and that's what I'm hoping to achieve from mm-hmm. Meditate the Vote, to wake up citizens, to become conscientious about their God-given powers and strength mm-hmm. that they have in themselves that might have gone to the wayside by waiting for someone to come and save them.
Hmm. Would it be correct if I said that the initial agenda in this kind of meditation is far more on self-introspection and reflection than it is on evaluating candidates in the election?
Absolutely. On the money. Because, you know, we're going to vote in whoever we are,
mm-hmm.
the person that we are at that point in mm-hmm. time. So as we begin to introspect mm-hmm. about our own state of awareness and state of being, then that's going to make an impact on mm-hmm. November 8th. It's
yeah.
going to play a huge role on November 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of who that is, at the end of the voting on November 8th, I still have to be my own self. Oh, Welton, I have to tell you, when we first started this, I started to hear Americans tell me, if so-and-so goes into power, I'm leaving this country,
mm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I've been hearing, which was a big surprise for me, is it doesn't matter who's in office, Sister Jenna, I still have to do what I'm doing.
Hmm.
And I thought, like, we're like giving up. How much are we giving to the nation? This mm-hmm. is my question.
Mm-hmm.
The hashtag is very simple, Meditate the Vote. The Facebook, the Twitter, it's all the same. The website, the same. And why the hashtagging and the social media is important is that we're inviting an engaging conversation with all citizens
mm-hmm.
to share online the things that they're going through and what they're feeling. One of my questions, too, is what do I value the most about America?
Hmm.
I mean, I've come from another country for the last 40-something years. This is what I know. And this is where I'm so driven to see how I can contribute to the nation rather than give up. I'll be the first one to tell somebody who's a foreigner who starts to say, oh, it's going down, there's nothing here, you know, they're not doing anything. I said, well, go back to where you've come from. Then why can't you start to give back something to a country that educated your children, that gave you a beautiful house, a great car, and some sense of freedom? What I'm saying to you is the country now needs you. The vibrations of the land need you to show up to now give something back to it. If we keep taking from America, it's going to get barren.
Mm-hmm. If someone calls you or calls into the Meditation Museum and says, I'm really trying to meditate the vote, I'm trying to do what you want us to do, what would you like to hear that person say they're doing and feeling?
I would love, firstly, for people to think about their own sense of responsibility, their intentions. Like, how do you wake up in the morning? What's your purpose? That's you.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I'd love for you to do is to video record a little video that says, I meditate the vote, and why? Maybe reply to one of the questions, such as, what do you value most about America, or do you believe in your self-worth, and share that with us on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Post it on your social media site, share it with your friends and family, and then, of course, come to our Facebook, Meditate the Vote, and Twitter page so that we can also begin to converse with you. What I'd love for people to do is to hold conversations at their homes with their kids. Children, tell me, what do you really like about the country? I want husbands and wives to really talk about something more meaningful and let us know what came out of those conversations, what mm-hmm. was amplified. Some other things that folks can do is, while they're at a coffee shop, Welton, bring up one of the questions.
Mm-hmm.
Take a picture, send it to us on our website, which you can find information on americameditating.org/events.
Mm-hmm.
there's an image there called Keep Calm and Meditate the Vote. You can download the image and just take a snapshot picture and let us know that you've meditated the vote. And I know that that's going to create a spirit in the atmosphere. You and I have been through the walls of many faiths. So after you have walked into a church, a synagogue, a temple, each of these spaces carry the vibration of the thoughts of people's minds. Similarly, if we can keep activating these peaceful thoughts or conscientious thoughts, or let me be informed so that when I speak, I don't sound ignorant. Mm-hmm. Even that is a vibration of your thoughts, and that's contributing to the environment in the country. What we're wanting is to feel that sense of safety in the country rather than the fear that we've been feeling for far too long as a nation.
If you were speaking to the presidential candidates, what would you say to convince them to join Meditate the Vote?
I would ask them, are you worthy enough? Do you believe in your self-worth? And could you please share with me how your life models that? Because I think that goes back to your place of intention. Who are you? What are you doing? Did you remember the national anthem and what it meant? You know, it's natural for all of us, Welton, when you're in a job or a business for too long, it just takes you over. You could be a businessman building buildings. After a while, it just takes you over to run business and build buildings. And when you're in the political realm for too long, it takes you over that you forget to come from the place of the God that's in you. You forget that you are a child of God, and you forget that the energy of God's qualities is what he wants to see as the power on the planet Earth. And so my first question would be, do you believe in your self-worth? And tell me, how does your life model that? And I would just pause and wait for them to think to see how they would respond to that question. And then the other one I would ask them is there a way that you use your own language to create unity? I mean, in the way that you are speaking to folks, do you think what you're saying creates unity, or does it create division or separation?
Sister Jenna is the founder of the Meditation Museum with two locations near our nation's capital. Sister Jenna is a popular teacher and a speaker and the host of the American Meditating Radio Show. Sister Jenna, I have to tell you, it's a delight to have this chance to talk with you today. I'm very happy to be able to tell our listeners about this campaign and to share this time with you on State of Belief Radio, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Welton, and all the very best to all the listeners as well.
Before we go, I want to just share a thought or two with you. They're burning in me. We're at a new place in this presidential campaign cycle. We're at a moment where I think the emphasis has moved, or should be moved, from politics to patriotism. Seldom have we in previous campaigns heard candidates, a number of candidates, campaigning on calls to alter the meaning of religious freedom in this nation, to take some religions as exemptions from protection for religious freedom. I don't understand the way in which candidates have talked about each other so extremely and so bitterly and so decisively, and in some instances have said of their opponents, or at least of one of their opponents, this person doesn't deserve to be president of the United States. This person would harm our country rather than help our country. That brings us to a whole new place. Because when you hear a candidate say that about a colleague who is a candidate, and then turn around and immediately endorse the one that has been condemned, that's not politics. That's lying. That's not politics. That's saying I will support my party quicker than I will support my country. And I think there are a lot of people who have been a part of this political campaign who now have a real struggle with integrity when it comes to patriotism. Is it more important to support a political party than it is to support what one thinks is best for this nation? It's a tough question because seldom have we ever been in a situation where we had that kind of antithetical polar opposites from which to choose. But that's where we are. And people in both parties are having to make a decision about whether I want to support the political party with which I've always been affiliated, or is it possible that I may need to say in the weeks ahead, we may lose this election, but I think it's more important for our party to lose this election than it is to compromise our nation. I hope you understand that I'm describing a situation which I don't think is about politics. I think it's about patriotism generally, and I also think it's about personal integrity. Things have changed. Stay tuned. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. We need your voice. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.